Okay, I really, like I say, I want to thank Rabbi Peres again, always for coming, especially at this hour. And I had the pleasure of meeting Rabbi Peres in South Africa in 2013, just before he took on his position of the chairman. Now he's like the executive chairman of World Mizrahi. Rabbi Peres had made Aliyah many years earlier, and they came to the people from his community in South Africa came to him and begged him to come back for 2 years. They need him in Johannesburg, and 2 years turned into 15 years, where he served as the rabbi of the large shul in Johannesburg. I had the pleasure of speaking there, and really welcome, and I was back in Israel doing a wonderful job at bringing Mizrahi back to life. So Rabbi Peres, yashar koach, and thank you. It's all yours. You can go ahead.
Thank you, Rav Jay. It's an honor and privilege to be with you. I'm sorry it's still Tisha B'Av there. It's 5 in the afternoon in Toronto. As Rav Jay said, it's 11 o'clock.
4 in the afternoon. So we still have an extra hour. We got till 9:30.
4 p.m. So,
okay.
So still a number of hours to go. And please God, they should go quickly and easily. And especially after Chatzot, where some of the restrictions are being lifted and it's more of a... it's lightening up a little bit. So, so as Rav Jay said, it's 11 p.m. Israel time, and I'm all freshened up and ready to share with you what I think is something really critical today, especially with what's going on in Israel. As Rav Jay said, I met him and Revitan Ilana 10 years ago. Ilana and a friend of mine, Cliffy Abrams, are first cousins. And so we connected also through family, and we've been in touch since then. And Yishar Koach for all the wonderful work you're doing in terms of Torah in motion. And it's a schut to be able to share some words at this really challenging time on the Jewish calendar in general, and for Am Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael in particular. And I've called the shiur maintaining relationships and arguing policy without delegitimizing the person. The ability to separate between a person's views and between their persona, who they are. Mel is asking, can we see the speaker? Should be able to see the speaker.
We see you fine. I see you fine. I'm still looking to find you on the screen to make you co-host, which for some reason, I have no idea why I can't, but okay. You keep going. I see you fine.
All right.
Go on.
All right. So, I want to introduce this topic by a famous quote of the Rambam, Maimonides. Those of you who have, there's a source sheet in the chat. If you have access to it, great. If not, I'll share it. It's not a problem. I'll give it as if you don't have a source sheet in front of you. And I want to share with you a fundamental Rambam, which explains to us the essence of why we are fasting and mourning today. The Rambam says in Hilchot Ta'anit Perikei, he says over there, there's a whole bunch of halachot where he explains what the fasts are about. And I'm going to share with you just the first two lines that he writes in the beginning of chapter 5. And just listen, it's very powerful, poignant, and relevant to our discussions today. He says, Yesh sham yamim, there are days shekol Yisrael mitanim bein, that everybody fasts, meaning it's days which have been decreed for Klal Yisrael, mipnei hatzarot she'ru bahen, because of tzoras that happened to the Jewish people. So we know that Tisha B'Av and all the other four minor fasts are fasts because of tzoras that happened to the Jewish people. Why do we fast? He says, kedei le'orer halevavot, in order to awaken us spiritually, v'liftach darkei tshuva. Any fast day, like Yom Kippur, the paradigmatic fast, even though these are very different, ones for these are for tragedies, the other Yom Kippur is not. But the purpose of a fast day is, he says, l'orer atlavot, to open our hearts, to awaken our hearts, and to prod us to do teshuvah, to look internally. And then is the powerful comment that he says. Listen carefully. He says, v'yeze, and our fasting and teshuvah on the day, yeh zikaron lemaaseinu, will be a reminder for our actions, haraim, our negative actions, umaasei avoteinu, and recall the negative actions of our forefathers and mothers, shehaya kemaaseinu ata, whose actions then are like our actions today, ad shegaram, and listen carefully, ad shegaram lahem velanu otana tzarot, just like it caused for them and us the same sort. The Rambam is clearly emphasizing a point mentioned in the Midrash, and that is, if we are fasting today and mourning today, it's not only because we are remembering the negative actions and consequences that happened to our forefathers and mothers, but it has direct reflection on our actions today. He twice says, we're remembering not only their negative actions, which caused the Khurban and their suffering, but ours, which maintains the Khurban and our suffering. And therefore, he says explicitly, the purpose of the fasts is to arouse us to teshuva, but the reason we are fasting is because we are also today still guilty of the same sins that our fathers and mothers were guilty of then. And it really is based in the Midrash. The Midrash famously says, Kol dor shebeit ha-midrash ha-mikdash lo bana, in every generation that the temple has not been rebuilt, ke'ilu charevba, it is if it has been destroyed. Meaning, the fact that the temple has not been rebuilt today is not because the actions of our forefathers and negative behavior has such far-reaching effect. It's because it has also penetrated and affected our actions. We are guilty for the same sins which caused the Khurban, which means that the reason we are still fasting and mourning, do not yet have a rebuilt temple, please God, soon and speedily in our days, is because we are culpable for the same sins which caused the destruction. All of you know the very famous Gemara, it's in source number 2, which I'll read to you, that the words are very, very powerful and need to be analyzed carefully. We all know that the salient reason given by our sages for the destruction of the second temple is, of course, causeless hatred. There are other reasons given. I'm going to touch on one more of them a little later when I try and drive the point home. A second reason given by Rabbi Yochanan in Masechet Bab Metzia. But this is the most famous reason given. And it's in the Talmud in Masechet Yoma, page 9b. It's in source number 2. Again, if you don't have the source in front of you, no problem. And there the Talmud says, "And Mikdash Sheni, but the second temple, why was it destroyed?" And here's the kicker. Shehayu oskim b'Torah. They learned Torah. Uba mitzvot, and they occupied themselves with mitzvot. Ugmilut chasadim, meaning the three qualities that they had undeniably. One, Torah learning. Two, fulfillment of mitzvot. And three, practice chesed. And even so, mipnei macharev, how come it was destroyed? This is not a generation which was guilty of the things that the first generation was, the impediments of the furthest destruction of the first temple. They seem to follow the mitzvot in Torah, and they seem to even display chesed. How could it have been destroyed? And then the Gemara famously and poignantly says, "Mipnei shaitabo sinat chinam," because that generation somehow was guilty of baseless hatred. Lelamedcha, sheshkula sinat chinam keneged shalosh averot, to teach us that causeless hatred, as we know, is the equivalent of the three cardinal sins of avodah zara. Gilui arayot, immorality, sexual immorality, ushvichut damim, and murder. And therefore, famously, the Gemara says that sinat chinam, baseless hatred, is equal to all the others. Now, I want to ask two, when I learned this for the first time, there are two things that really bothered me. And really, this whole shiur is to try and answer these questions. Two questions. Firstly, what is sinat chinam? What is baseless hatred? Have you ever met somebody who hates somebody for no reason? I've never met such a person. I've never met a person who says, I hate that person. Why? Because I just do. Why? No reason. They've done nothing to me. They don't upset me. I just hate them. In fact, the temple's destroyed because of me, because I'm a baseless hater. People who dislike other people have generally got good reasons. Not that those reasons are good enough to hate them, but at least in their own mind, they've got good reasons. What does it mean to hate somebody chinam, for free, for nothing, without reason, without cause? What does that mean? And then the thing which really, really bothered me is when you learn the source, how can it possibly be that a generation of people who had all three qualities, each one of these qualities in and of themselves, should preclude any detrimental quality of sinat chinam? If you have any of these three, how can at the same time you have the diametrically opposed quality of sinat chinam? Meaning, if you're a person that, as the Talmud says, who learns Torah, that whole generation study Torah. Now, if you study Torah, how can you study Torah and hate people? How does that work? And even if somehow this anomaly can work. How can you hate people and keep the mitzvot? Sorry, how can you study Torah and keep the mitzvot and still be culpable of hating people? After all, on some of the mitzvot, v'ahavta recha kamocha, loving your fellow person as yourself, lo tisna achicha bilvavecha, do not hate another person in your heart. How is it possible? How is it possible that a person can study Torah, keep all of the mitzvot, including ben adam lechavero, and still be guilty of this sin? It just doesn't make sense. And perhaps the strangest of all is Gomlei Chassidim. It says they were a generation defined by the fact that they were people who practiced chesed. And if you practice loving kindness, how can you hate the person? Can you practice loving kindness to somebody and hate them at the same time? How does that work? So this source really, if I repeat it, is this is a challenge. Two questions. One, how can it possibly be that people can hate people for no reason? What does sinat chinam mean? Number two, how can you have these qualities, especially gemilut chassidim, which I want to focus on, and still be accused of hating somebody? So the person, one of the people who answers the question, I'm going to start with the second question, which is how can it be that you can be accused of sinat chinam and at the same time be praised for your chesed, is the Netziv, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. In fact, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, known as the Netziv, short for Rav Naphtali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was an important person not only in the Yeshiva world as the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, the mother of all Lithuanian Yeshivot. He was also a deep supporter of Chovevei Tzion, of the return to the land. In fact, his son, his first wife passed away. He remarried the daughter of the Aruch HaShulchan, the great Rav Yechiel Michal Halevi Epstein, the great Rebbe of Navardok and Slobotka, and the Beitin, and the author of the famous halachic work Aruch HaShulchan. He married his daughter, and they had one son, and their son's name was Rebbe Meir Berlin, who changed his name to Meir Bar Ilan. And he's very famous because Bar Ilan University is named after him. He died in 1949. He was one of the founders of Mizrahi. He built Mizrahi in the United States, where he moved from Germany and later in Israel. In fact, our building in King George Street, 54 King George, is called Beit Meir after him. These were his offices. He passed away soon after the establishment of the state, a year later. Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan and his father was the great Netziv. And the Netziv says an unbelievable thing. It's a very, very powerful and famous passage, which I'm only going to quote a small part. In his introduction to the book of Bereshit, the Netziv says the most incredible thing. And I'm going to read it to you. It's in source number 3. And again, if you don't have the sources, I'm just going to read it. He says, how can it be that they were people who were tzaddikim and learned and studied Torah and did chesed and were not straight and hated people? And this is what, listen to what he says. It's very, very powerful and very sad. He says, Al kain mipnei shesinat chinam shebelibam, because they had causeless hatred in their heart. And what does it mean? He explains. She chashdu ze et ze. Everybody suspected the other. She ra'u noheg shelo kedat amirat Hashem. Anyone who didn't follow my path of Torah, didn't follow the path that I had chosen, were not part of my community, didn't dress the way I did, didn't speak the way I did, didn't think the way I did, didn't practice the way I did, they suspected them of being, listen to his words, of a tziduki v'apikoros. He said they Sadducees and they apikorosim, they kofrim, that people who don't believe in the Torah. Meaning, anyone who did not follow my path and disagreed with my understanding of Torah and didn't keep Torah the way I wanted to, was literally considered holy, with an W, holy delegitimized. They are not, their path is not an alternate path of Torah. It's a path of being a Sadducee and an Apikoros. And Rachman Alitzanu Va'al Yedai Zen, because of this, they even came to Shfichut Damim, Bederech HaPalaga, and through their dissension and Machlokot, they even came to murder, the Cholarot Ba'olam, and all the terrible things, Achichareh Vabayit, until the temple was destroyed. Therefore, says the Netziv, a powerful thing. The people that they hated were not the people that they displayed loving kindness to. The people who that generation was said were displayed loving kindness and had a gmach for everything was for their own community. for their community, they were outstanding. They looked after their own community. They learned, they kept mitzvot, they did chesed. But if you were not part of my community, if you did not think the way I did, didn't act the way I didn't look the way I did, if you and how you conduct yourself threatened me and my community, you were wholly disqualified, demonized, and delegitimized to the extent, says the Netziv, that you were suspected of being an apikoros, a Sadducee, a heretic. And therefore, it's such a sad and powerful thing. The Netziv famously goes on to explain how the difference between the avot and imahot, the mothers and fathers of the generation of Bereshit, is indeed exactly the defining difference between our mothers and fathers and the sages, meaning the sages, those who were guilty of sinat chinam. He says it is possible to be a tzaddik and a chassid, meaning not chassid in terms of chassidus today, meaning a pious and righteous person, bein adam lechavero, so bein adam lemakom, between you and God, and even practice loving kindness partially to people around you, and at the same time not be yashar, not to be straight. The Netziv says a person who's yashar, how can they possibly display hatred in their heart to anyone? How can they do that? And therefore the Netziv said that generation were not yasharim. They were not straight in the ways of Hashem, because it's crooked if you display suspicious hatred to others. And therefore the Netziv has these very powerful words, and unfortunately so relevant to us today. They are absolutely true historically from a number of sources. Flavius Josephus, in his book, The War of the Jews, I'm sure you're all familiar with Flavius Josephus. If you're not, I'll just briefly say that Josephus, his name is Yosef ben Matityahu. He was one of the generals in the great rebellion against the Romans. He was a pious man and a general, and he was the commander defending the northern town of Yotfat in the Galilee. And when his city fell and got taken captive by the Romans during the Merida Gadol on their way to the destruction of the temple, he, in order to save himself, switched sides. He said he has a skill of being a historian and chronicler. He's a good writer. So essentially what he did is he walked behind the Roman army and chronicled all of their battles in the Holy Land. And therefore, so much of what we know has been chronicled by Josephus, Yosef ben Matityahu. He became known. He took on the Roman name of, instead of Yosef, Josephus Flavius. He survived and went to Rome afterwards, where he continued to keep Torah and mitzvot. And a lot of what we know is from the book. And he has a shocking, shocking description of the destruction of the temple. I have a short quote from source number 4. I'll just tell you the context. The context is that after a lengthy siege of the city of Jerusalem during the destruction, Vespasian, Aspasianus, the Roman general or the chief of staff, who was to become the emperor in that year, was besieging the city of Jerusalem. Vespasian or Aspasianus became king that year. By the way, in Roman history, the year 69 CE, the year before, the 1 year before the destruction in 70, is known as the year of the four emperors. There were four different emperors who died or were killed during that year. The fourth of those is Vespasian. So indeed, in the middle of his siege in Jerusalem, he went and became, was promoted to emperor, was called back by the Senate, and he became the emperor of Rome in the year 69 CE, in the midst of the siege of Jerusalem. His son, infamous son, Titus, would then take over. And of course, the following year, be the one with credited with the destruction of the temple. Vespasian, Aspasianus, during that year before the temple was destroyed, in the year of the siege, had a discussion with his generals. And his generals say to him, Vespasian, we have been besieging the Jews for a long time. They are weak. They are hungry. They are not unified. It's now time to go in for the kill. There's no ways they can beat us. They really are totally, there's a lot of strife between them. They're hungry. We know from the kinot, the terrible suffering and the hunger that was taking place at the time of the Khurban. Now's the time to go in. And then Vespasian says the most shocking thing, which I want to share with you. It comes from book 4, chapter 6, in the War of the Jews. I'm just going to read it to you. It's in source number 4, but I'll read it to you. Vespasian replied to his generals, "You are greatly mistaken that you think the right thing is to attack. Absolutely not. If we do that, we will be doing something hazardous to ourselves and we'll be losing our advantage." He says, "The moment you decide to attack the Jews, our enemies, they will unite. In fact, the very attack will be that will unite them. They will come together and they will be very difficult to defeat. But if we just wait it out, they will consume themselves by their own sedition." And then he has a shocking line. I remember when I read it, I couldn't believe it. He said, "God acts as a general of the Romans better than any Roman general." He says, you know, we've got an outside, we've got God, because God is, he's helping us. He's helping us fight our own wars. He's just waiting for them to, he's facilitating the fact that they're just destroying themselves. God acts as a Roman general better than he can. And he is giving the Jews to us without any pain of our own. If we go into battle, many of us will die. If we just wait it out, they'll destroy themselves. And he will grant the army victory without any danger, while the enemies are destroying each other with their own hands and falling into the greatest misfortune of their own sedition. Let us sit as spectators of the dangers that befall of these people who love murdering and are mad one against the other. What a terrible description, where Josephus says that Vespasian says, "Chevra, the Jews are outstanding in times of war. They put the differences aside. They come together. They fight ki'ish echad b'lev echad. If we go and fight now, we will unite them and we will be emboldening them and enabling them to cause much opposition to us. But if we just wait it out, unfortunately, in their time of Taurus amongst themselves, they're not uniting. They are, unfortunately, fighting with one another." What a terrible description. We also know that in the book of, in the scrolls of Qumran, we know that archaeologists found in the caves of Qumran post 1967, after the areas of Masada and the Dead Sea, meaning not Masada, but many of the areas around the Dead Sea came under Israeli control, they found the caves of Qumran. And in these caves where many of the sects live, Kanire, it seems that they were the Essenes. One of the sects lived there. They found many scrolls. And one of the shocking scrolls that they found was a scroll where the Essenes, one of the Katot, one of the sects, say that all those who follow them are what's called the sons of light. And all the other sects are known as the sons of darkness. It's very famous. It's become a very famous quote in Israeli society where you say, "Bnei Haor, you've got the sons of light and the sons of darkness." And basically what happened in the caves of Qumran, it explains to us that each sect saw the other as darkness. They were totally delegitimized. You had all different sects. You had the rabbinic, the rabbis, and those who followed the strict, the Torah mitzvot were called the Pharisees, or the No, I've just gone blank. The Tzidukim and the New Rav Jay, I've gone blank.
The Sadducees and the Pharisees.
I'm saying
Prushim.
The Prushim. I just went blank in Hebrew for a minute. You've got the Tzidukim and the Prushim. You've got the Sadducees and the Pharisees. You've got the Essenes, known as the Beitusim. You've got the Kanaim and a different group of Zealots called the Sikarim. And yet all these different sects with different, perceptions, one of the other. And basically, they viewed the others totally delegitimized and demonized. And essentially, as the Netziv said, everyone who wasn't like them was a heretic, was part of the forces of evil in the world. The world is very simple. You're either good or bad. You are part of light, you are part of darkness. And that was the great challenge of the monolithic, very simplistic, delegitimizing and demonizing way that they saw things. So much so that in the time of their greatest Taurus, where they should have come together, they were tearing themselves apart, which is what, of course, Josephus Flavius shared. Very concerning. That's the Sinat Chinam that happened then in that generation, which ultimately, as we said, was because the people that they loved and showed chesed to were not the people who they displayed hatred towards. Now, in Sefer HaCharedim, this is source number 5. Sefer HaCharedim is a book written by one of the great sages of Tzfat. His name was Rabbi Eliezer Azikri, or Azkari. He's the author of a song that all of us know and sing both on Erev Shabbat, Lel Shabbat, and after Shabbat, known as Yedid Nefesh. Yedid Nefesh. And Yedid Nefesh appears in this book as this poem that he wrote. And it's a book about the mitzvot. He basically categorizes the mitzvot in a specific way. And he was one of the great Kabbalists of Tzfat at the time of the Arizal, the Shulchan Aruch. And as I said, he's the author of Yedid Nefesh, the most beautiful, powerful love song in the theme of Shir HaShirim. I want to read to you what he says in chapter 66 of Sefer HaCharedim regarding Sinat Chinam. It's in source number 5, but I'll just read it. It's just 2 lines. He says, regarding Sinat Chinam, how can you have Sinat Chinam? It says explicitly in the Torah, Lo tisna tachicha bilvavecha. Do not hate your brother and sister in your heart. Don't hate your fellow Jew, or anyone for that matter, but certainly not your fellow Jew in your heart. And he says, Vehi shoresh kol ha-ra'ot, the root of all evil is this hatred. Re'ei ma garma sinat Yosef lechav. Look what the hatred between Yosef and his brothers caused. The original Jewish family, Bnei Yisrael, look at the hatred that one was prepared to sell the other one. That the brothers reached the shocking conclusion that Yosef was a danger to the future of Jewish destiny. And it says 3 times that they hated him. They were jealous of him. They hated him. The most hatred you see in the Torah is the brothers to Yosef. It says they hated him. They hated him even more. And then they hated him even more. There was such hatred without going into that whole parsha. And look what their hatred saw. They were the sons of light, and he was the son of darkness, who they even reached a conclusion that needed to be left for the dead. And he said, look what it caused. Look at the death, almost death and destruction, what it did to their father and what it did to the first Jewish family. Ra'ei ma garma sinat Yosef lechav al sinat chinam anu begalut ha'aroch hazen. We are in this long galut, exile, because of that. Yoter mikol agay galuyot shayu b'sipot avodat elilim v'gilarot. He says, the cardinal sins were responsible for, right? Murder, immorality, and idolatry caused a 70-year galut. But sinat chinam has caused a galut of thousands of years. And he says, and here his powerful line ends with, he says, ukeshem sheva after recha kamocha, just as we know Rabbi Akiva taught us, the principle of loving our fellow person as ourselves is such an important klal, kolel kiyum kol haTorah, encompasses the whole Torah. Kach hasina lehefer. Hatred is exactly the opposite. Hating others causes to transgress the entire Torah. Just as loving other people is the essence of the whole Torah, hating others is the opposite. And that is the danger of Sinat Chinam. He says it's the source of all evil, and he says it's the opposite of Vavta. Just as the loving, the famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbat Lamed Aleph, where the convert comes to Rabbi Hillel HaZaken and says, Hillel, can you convert me on one leg? And he says, I can. I can teach you. I can begin your process by teaching you the number one principle of the Torah, what became known as the Golden Rule. The Sani Lach L'Chavarach Al Tavid. Anything you don't like to be done to you, don't do to anyone else. Meaning in every situation you'll find yourself in, ask yourself one question. Am I treating this other person the way I would like them to treat me in a similar situation? And if you can walk around treating people in this way, he says, you've got the essence of the Torah. And just like that is the positive essence of the Torah, says Rabbi Elazar Zikri Sefer HaCharedim, the negative essence of the Torah is behaving in a way which emanates from hatred. In source number 6, in Masechet Gittin, as part of Agadat HaKorban, I'm not going to read all of it, but it's a famous Gemara which talks about how the wealthy men of Jerusalem, Nakdimon ben Gurion, Kalbas Savoy, was the father-in-law, would become the father-in-law of Rabbi Akiva, and Ben Tzitzita Kesatz. These three wealthy people sustained the city during the time of the Khurban. But then it says that the zealots of Jerusalem came along, and the sage and said, the Chachamim wanted to make peace with Rome. They said, there's no way we can continue withstanding the siege. It's time to give in and see what we can save. The famous Rabbi Yochanan, who wanted to have Yavne v'Chachamea, the zealots wouldn't allow them to do it. They could not reach an agreement. And eventually, in order to make sure that nobody would give in, they did a terrible thing. And it says that the zealots arose and burnt down the storehouses of wheat and barley, and there became a famine in the city. Meaning, we had years and years and years of supplies of storehouses of wheat, barley, and grain. And what did the zealots do? They burnt them. In Hebrew, it's known as Sreifata Asamim. In Hebrew jargon today, especially in the last number of weeks, you keep hearing, although each side says to the other side, why are you burning down the warehouses? It's become the colloquial catchphrase to say doing things of self-destruction. And so in Israeli jargon, you hear a lot of these two expressions, B'nei Ha'or v'B'nei Choshech. You hear the other side of we've got the light and they are the children of darkness. And the other expression we hear a lot is each side says to the other side, you're acting like extremists, and why are you burning down the storehouses of food, ultimately causing self-destruction. Now, I want to share, I believe. Now, what is Sinat Chinam? What is Sinat Chinam? We answered the first question where we said that the fact that you can have loving kindness and still hate somebody is because, unfortunately, the people that they displayed loving kindness towards were not the people they were hating. But what is Sinat Chinam? What is baseless hatred? It seems that baseless hatred doesn't mean you don't think you've got a reason to hate somebody. Obviously, each one had a very good reason to hate somebody. But it seems that what baseless hatred is, if you have a reason to hate and dislike what somebody says, that should not be a reason to dislike and hate them. The ability to hold these two things together, that I vehemently disagree with you, and I detest what you say, and I believe what you're saying is wrong, but at the same time, I don't disqualify you. I don't delegitimize the person. In sport, we used to say, in football or soccer in South Africa, we used to say, play the ball, not the man. When you're playing football or soccer, you're not allowed to foul the man, the other person. You can't, meaning your aim has got to get the ball from them and put the ball in the goal. Your aim isn't to go and injure the other person and to commit fouls and to play dirty. So sometimes when people play dirty, they forget that the aim of sport is to play the ball. Be tough. Play tough. Give it all you got. Kick the ball as hard as you can. Tackle your opponent as hard as you want to. But play by the rules. And the rules are play the ball, not the man. And the moment you cannot distinguish between the rules of the game, i.e. the actions of the other, who has possession of the ball, and you end up fouling the person nonstop, and injuring them, and especially when it's done on purpose, you are no longer playing according to the rules of the game. What you are doing is you are playing the man, the person, and not the ball. This is the great challenge we have. How can we have strong views without canceling the other, delegitimizing the other, and demonizing the other? And the greatest example we have, I'd say the two greatest examples we have, I want to share with you in the final two sources. In source number 7, it's a very famous source, and I think it's one of the most important sources that there are regarding this topic. And it's, of course, regarding the two schools of rabbinic thought, which argue amongst themselves almost in every page of Mishnah and Gemara. And they, of course, are the schools of Beit Shammai and the school of Beit Hillel. Boy, oh boy, did they argue with each other. And it says in the famous Gemara in source number 7, Masech Yavamot 14b, it says, Toshima, come and listen. Af al pi shenech laku Beit Shammai Beit Hillel b'tzarot, uba chayot, b'get yashan, uba savek eshadish, uba ngarech et ishto, b'lanu uba fundak, b'kesu uba shavek kesu. But basically, they argued about everything. Every sugya of marriage and divorce, they argued about. They argued about who's a Jew. They argued about considered a convert. Who's a mamzer? When's a person an eshet ish? When they're not? They argued about the validity of divorces. Who you can marry, who you can't. Basically, every single sugya that you can think about on some of the most important things. Who's a mamzer? The one thought somebody's considered a halachic mamzer, I mean you can't marry them. Another one said they are. They basically argued about everything in divorce and marriage. And many other sugyas. And even so, listen to what the Gemara says. Lo nimnu Beit Shammai milisan Hashem Beit Hillel, velo Beit Hillel mi Beit Shammai. And what did they never do? They never found a halachic reason not to marry one another. Meaning, even though halachically they couldn't agree on anything, imagine what the wedding would look like of their children. They wouldn't be able to agree on the size of the cup, the type of wine, the structure of this. they might not even agree if the Chatan and Kala are eligible for marriage. Meaning they had deep, deep halachic arguments. And yet they always found a way. They always found a way, always, that their children could marry each other. What were they able to do? They were able to distinguish between the person and their view, between what the person, the halachic ruling is, and who the person is. And that is something, unfortunately, which many are not able to do. And I want to read for you beautifully what they based this on. It says, Lilla Meidcha, listen to our ends, to teach you, Shechiba v're'ut nohagim zebaze, love and brotherhood and friendship was between them, even though they disagreed vociferously. Lekayem ma shenemar, to fulfill the scriptural verse which says, you should love truth and peace. Lekayem ma shenemar, as it says in Zechariah, Zechariah 8, ha'emet v'ashalom ehavu, truth and peace should go together. Now, what is truth and peace? I'm just going to read for you from the Tanakh. The source isn't in your sources. Zechariah has a very famous prophecy where he says that the days of Tish'a B'Av, Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, and all the fasts are actually going to turn into simchas. And I'm going to read it to you. It's in chapter 8 of Zechariah, Psukim. Let me just find the pasuk in a moment. Here we go. Pasuk 18. Chapter 8, 18. I'm going to read it to you from the Tanakh. It goes as follows. Vayhi dvar Hashem tzvakot elai lemor, says Zechariah, God spoke to me prophetically saying, Kwa amar Hashem tzvakot, this is what the Lord of hosts said, Hatzom harevi'i, the fast of the fourth month, i.e. Tammuz. Vatzom hachamishi, the fast of the fifth month, Av. Vatzom hashvi'i, in the fast of the seventh month, which is Tzom Gedalia in Tishrei. Vatzom ha'asiri, in the fast of the tenth month, the tenth of Tevet. Yihiye lebeit Yehuda l'sasun l'simchat, will be for the house of Judah, for sason and simcha, for happiness, ulamadim tovim. These days of mourning and fasting will be transformed into days of celebration, into a yontif. And he says, and what will happen when it happens? The ha'emet v'ashalom ehavu. And it'll happen, and when it happens, it'll fulfill the fact that peace and truth will live together. And that is what, how Hillel and Shammai behaved to each other, how their houses behaved to each other, that they vehemently disagreed about everything, but still found a way to get past all these disagreements, to love each other and to get married together, is the fulfillment of this verse. So amazingly, this verse is the key to the fact that how are the fasts, which are all about the Churban Beit HaMikdash, and that the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, what's the key to make that happen? The key to make it happen is finding a way that peace and truth should live by each other. Ladies and gentlemen, we all know how hard that is. Some people are people of truth. They've got a passion for truth. But then they don't tolerate so easily people who disagree with them, because they're people of truth. They don't want to mollycoddle, and they don't want to accept things which they don't see as truth. And often people of truth find it very difficult to be flexible in their acceptance of others. And often you find people of love and shalom often, you know, smooth over the differences, ignore the truths, and don't always seem to display truth in the purest way. There's a contradiction here. In fact, there's the famous Gemara which speaks about what should a person who sees a kala say. There was a custom that when you saw the kala, the bride, you would say, kala na'av chasuda. You would say, it's a beautiful and praiseworthy and righteous bride. But what happens if you happen to know that the bride is either not beautiful in your eyes or not praiseworthy in actions? So what does Beit Hillel say? Beit Hillel says, what, you're going to offend the person, the color on, at the time of their marriage. Doesn't matter what you think. Just say, Kalan Ava Chasuda. That was the custom. Beit Shammai says, but that's a lie. What happens if I don't find her attractive at all, in any stretch of the imagination, or I know that she's not righteous and praiseworthy? How can I say a lie? So Beit Shammai said he's not prepared to do that. So here's an example of Beit Shammai sticking by the truth and Beit Hillel saying it doesn't matter exactly what you think if you're going to hurt somebody else. So nu, is it truth or peace? And if you're a peaceful person, then maybe you're compromising the truth. The answer is, of course, we have to find a way for peace and truth to live together. There has to be a way to be truthful. And as I say to say, Shivim panim la Torah. You can have the truth of Torah, but it might have 70 parts. There might be other truths. There might be even the objective truth of Torah may have different paths to that truth. And therefore, truth, as it affects the human world, has to have multiple paths. It cannot be that there's only one path of the truth. Yes, the Torah is absolutely true, and we believe 100%, but the way we live Torah, interpret Torah, and understand Torah may have different paths, different understandings, and it may all be part of the same truth. In fact, the verse brought where it says that there are 70 faces or facets of the Torah, Shivim Panim Torah, it quotes a pasuk in Jeremiah, which says, Kepatish Yefotzetzel. It's like a sledgehammer, a hammer, which breaks the stone. It's almost like when the Torah came down to Horeb, we know that Sinai, the name given in the Torah is Horeb, which means a desolate place or a stone, a rock. Almost like when the Torah came down in Sinai, and as it hit the rock of the mountain burst into 70 different pieces. Basically, what it's saying is that the moment God's objective truth comes into the world, a world of subjective human understanding, a world where no two people have the same opinion, a world where people have different upbringings, different understandings, different ideology, different perceptions, different qualities, there has to be multiple ways to approach the Torah. And therefore, when will the Beit HaMikdash be rebuilt and these days be turned into days of Sason V'Simcha, when we're able to have truth which works with Shalom? And I want to share with you a very powerful Gemara, less well known than the one of Sinat Chinam, but also given as a reason for the destruction of the temple. It appears in Masechet Bab Metzia, Daf Lamed, page 30, and it says that the following thing. Listen to this. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, why was the temple destroyed? Why was the temple destroyed? It says Rabbi Yochanan, Mipnei she nagu din Torah, because they went according to din Torah. They went according to the words of Torah. Says the Gemara in Masechet Bab Metzia, the reason the temple was destroyed is when people followed the Torah. What other rules do we have other than the rules of the Torah? How can you possibly say that the temple was destroyed because people followed the laws of the Torah? And answers the Gemara, they followed the laws of the Torah. Nahagu lefi shurat adin, velo nahagu lifni mishurat adin. They followed the letter of the law, but they didn't follow the spirit of the law. You see, the letter of the law can prove that you're right. If you have a case, Rashi brings this in Parshat Dvarim, on the words, Echal Chalavadi, Tarchichem, Amasachem, Rifchem. Rashi says, when he complains, how could I put up all of your cumbersomeness and your burdensomeness? Rashi famously says, you know why you're so cumbersome? Because every time there was a machloket between you, one person brought Adim that they were right witnesses, another person brought counter witnesses that they were right. And the moment one person saw that the other person was winning, they brought more witnesses and wanted to go to a higher court. They basically spent their lives fighting in court. Basically, we all know how you can fight to be right and destroy a relationship at the same time. When there was a rise a number of decades ago in Israel of car accidents and road rage in Israel, there was a very famous aphorism, famous line on a bumper sticker, and it's such a powerful thing. It said people had on their cars and bumper stickers, it says, Al tiyeh sodek, tiyeh chacham. Don't be right, be smart. Meaning it could be that somebody went in front of you, and it could be that somebody didn't give you the right of way, and it could be that somebody did something they should have done. Okay, you are right. Shkoyach. What are you going to do about it? Are you the police? Are you going to go and stop them? Are you going to have a fight with them? Are you going to make gestures towards them? Meaning you're right. Shkoyach, you're right. Al tiyeh chacham, tzodek tiyeh chacham. In relationships, it's never about whether you're right. It's about whether you are smart. If you want to maintain and build a relationship, it is irrelevant whether we are right. It is more important whether we're smart to find a way to live with other people. Incredibly, I remember as a rabbi, when I was a community rabbi in South Africa, I'm now head of an organization, but when I was a community rabbi in South Africa, I remember so often trying to make peace between families, especially in Erev Yom Kippur with siblings who didn't talk and all types of issues, which I think is actually the main job of Erev Rosh Hashanah, of Erev Yom Kippur, is to bring people together. And the challenge is always so challenging. And I remember often hearing a line from people saying, you know, Rabbi, it's really about the principle. It's about the principle. And I used to say to them, why is it about the principle? Where in life is it written? Can you give me a source where the Torah says you should have a faribble with somebody because of a principle? Where does it say that? I used to say it never says it's about a principle. It's about the person. I said, if you're too much of a person of truth, that everything that's important to you is principles. I said, firstly, if it's about the principle, then you should join the police force and go and stop people every time they do something wrong. It's about the principles, become a teacher and teach people principles the whole day. But in human interactions, which is not an authoritative relationship, it's not an educational relationship, it's one of connection. The role is to get on with people, for God's sake. Our role as Jews and human beings is to get on with people. That's our role. And whether we're right or not is not relevant. If you're in a court of law, it depends who's right. And even in a court of law, famously, the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin says that before you sit and try explore the avenues of truth of Edim, which can go on forever, what should you do? You should try have what's called pshara. We seat them down in front of the judge and say, guys, before we open up all the witnesses, and before we end up spending days, weeks, months, and sometimes years and decades fighting in court, trying to prove who's right, can we try resolve this between us? Forget about who's right. Is there a way that we can resolve this in a way that we can move on with our lives civilly? And if the answer is no, that's fine. We'll fight it out in court. That's what courts are for. And you need that because sometimes one party is being unreasonable. Sometimes one party has stolen from the other. And you have to have courts of law. That's what they're there for. We have misunderstandings between people. We have unreasonable people. But before we get into all of that, is there a way that we can solve this through peace before going the path of din and truth? And that is our great challenge. To go according to Shurat HaDin, to the letter of the law, means to stand up for exactly what, you know, the simple reading is. But there's something called beyond the letter of the law. When it comes to human relationships, beyond the letter of the law means it is better to get on with people than to be right in relationships. And so many laws, there's also a number of halachot. By the way, there's one halacha, famous halacha, that if you want to sell your house, you should first offer it to your neighbor. Why? Because it's a much bigger advantage to your neighbor. Obviously, it's provided they give you the price that you want, not that you can get a higher price from someone else. But if you've got the price that you want, you should offer to the person next door, because just by simply doing that, you make such a difference in their life. If they want to bash down a wall and build a bigger house, you don't have to do that. You don't have to, but it's the right thing to do. And the right thing to do is the right thing to do. And I want to say, this is exactly the challenge we have in Israel today. I think one of our challenges, of Rav Kook says about Jews, four times the Torah calls us an Am Kshei Orif, a stiff-necked people. Rav Kook explains that a stiff-necked people is a person. When can we, you know, sometimes when we're stiff-necked, we can't move our neck. Don't you ever try to drive when you have a sore neck? Very, very difficult. It's hard to know what it means to have a normal neck until you have a sore, stiff neck. But now, whenever I've had a stiff neck, it's so difficult to drive. You can't look to the side. You can't see what's going on. And says Rav Kook, you know what a stiff-necked person is? A person who only sees the way, their way. They can't see any other direction. They can't see to the left, to the right, behind that stiff neck. We seem to be very good at being passionate about truth. Very good. And we stiff-necked. Yeah, everyone's got their truth and everyone's right. And boy, oh boy, are we right. As Jews, we've got strong views. We are for truth, and we've got a passion for truth and conviction and passionate. But we also have to get on with each other. And unfortunately, we're a lot better at getting on with each other when there's Torahs than they are when they aren't. We stood together, ki ish echad b'lev echad at Har Sinai. And then straight afterwards, we started arguing and complaining. When there's wars in Israel, we get together unbelievably. Our greatest challenge is how do we stay together in times of peace? And I think what's happening now with the governments, last government, this government, the judicial reform, all of these things, it's bringing out some of the deep challenges and fissures in Israeli society. What's the centrality of democracy and universal values? What's the centrality of Judaism and religious values? What's the centrality of national values? And all these different perceptions are coming to the fore, and we're not going to, it's too complicated to get into now, but these issues are there, and we have a real, real challenge. And we are in desperate need of leaders whose aim is to put forward a way that we can work this out together. We've managed to do this until now. Granted, our enemies have helped us. Every once in a while, there's a war and a thing which brings us together. And it's unfortunate. And perhaps we only have these wars and skirmishes and battles because we aren't able to stand together. But what's happening in Israel is very, very alarming. And everyone's right. Everyone's right. The right are right because 64 mandates. And yes, Simcha Rotman wrote books about this. And yes, this was part of the platform of their government. And yes, Yariv Levin's been talking about it for years. They're right. And the left is also right to feel that this is moving very quickly and might, if it goes to its nth degree, destroy the foundations of democracy. Everyone's got a very good point. Okay, Shkoyach, can we work this out now? How can we move forward on this? And it's really, really testing and challenging. And we're really going to need leadership, which is able to say, how can we work this out together? The left have to acknowledge that the right wing won the elections. And yes, the demography in Israel is changing. And right to make changes is, if we believe in democracy, the majority has, first and foremost, is rule of the majority. But the right has to also accept that you can't, as de Tocqueville said, the tyranny of the majority. You get a slight majority, and then you can very easily torment the minority. And therefore, there has to be an understanding that if we want a sustainable society, it's not whether you've got the right to do it, it's whether you should do it. And if the other side has got real and genuine concerns, and a strong minority is feeling disenfranchised potentially, and things are done in a way which could affect the very foundation of a unified society, there needs to be circumspection. Change has to be evolutionary, not revolutionary. And it has to begin with getting out of this siach, this conversation of the sons of light and the sons of darkness, the ability to delegitimize a person because of their views. And boy, oh boy, is it difficult. At the moment in Israel, I've never seen things like this at the moment where people just cannot hear the other side. They can't hear the other side. I've got so many examples that people are not even prepared to hear the other side. The other side, each side, you can't talk to them. And it's a real, real challenge that we have. And that, Bezrat Hashem, I'm going to stop so we can answer questions for the remaining 3 minutes. I know there are quite a few questions in the chat. Rajay, I'll leave it to you to see which question I should deal with, or if anyone wants to ask, because I know some people have responded to some of that.
Thank you very much. I think the best question, the most important one, and you don't have time in 2 minutes to answer this, of course. The message on talk about how do we get our leaders to grasp this? How do we develop these leaders? That's really the problem. I think we all acknowledge that. It's the problem's at the top, but the people, it's much, there's much more cohesive.
Yeah.
So I'm just reading what Harvey wrote, but I'm totally there, 100%. And I know we have personally discussed it. Two of us have discussed this privately. It's not a simple thing. I mean, I agree. The message is
not at all.
And the Nitziv, I love to quote that Nitziv, a very powerful, very, very important Nitziv. And let's see if there are any other questions before we, welcome
Dr. Looking down as well.
Dr. Press Schwartz, 60. Okay. Yeah. Whatever. Right. I mean, it was very scary yesterday. I don't know what
it's saying, like.
Rabbi, I saw yesterday that 28% of Israelis now are thinking of moving out of the country. I don't know what is normal. I don't know in Canada, how many people want to move out of Canada, but I guess it's like 1%. I can imagine. So it's a pretty scary number. I don't know if you want to comment on that. I don't want to get too political. We avoided politics.
Yeah.
But talking not politically, just conceptually, I don't know.
I'll say it like this in the 2 minutes that I was just looking at all the questions. Look, the issues. Oh, hang on, let me just. My ideas.
You went upside down, like what's going on today?
Okay, it's okay. I'm just going to leave it as it is like this. Okay, I'll say like this. Every crisis is a great opportunity for growth. We know that the very word in Hebrew, mashber, crisis, is the same word as the birth stool of the, for birth. And who, there was one, I can't remember which leader said, never let a good crisis go by, unutilized. This is a real crisis in Israel today. There's a real clash of narratives and vision between what Israel stands for and what it should be. It needs to be handled very, very delicately. I believe I'm also a little bit involved in this behind the scenes with some of the politicians, because this is only going to work behind the scenes, not in front of the scenes. I'm hoping now that the right wing have got some type of win, even though I must say it's a win. They've changed one small thing in this reasonableness clause. And from their point of view, they felt that they had to do it because it's one small thing and that they said that they needed to do it. The challenge is if they're going to keep making changes like that, the way just keep going, it's going to be really, really divisive. And I'm hoping now that everyone has seen the price of making a change is that there will now be discussion. I believe there will be. I believe everyone is seeing. I believe that the right wing, from their point of view, had to make this one change in order to be able to say, you know what, we were elected, we're going to do something, and it's the most minuscule change from their point of view. However, if the change is going to continue to be made like this, it's going to be a real challenge. I must tell you, I read all the newspapers on the left and the right. It's unbelievable to see how each one picks, just picks a vantage point and goes with it. And on the left, I don't want to get into this whole thing now, but a lot of this alarming thing of all the people joining, it's not always those numbers. I'm aware of some of the people who organize these things and the numbers are inflated to scare. There's a lot of scare tactics and positioning going on. And that's on the one hand. And on the right hand side, barreling forward and making changes no matter what. And everyone's positioning themselves. And Be'ezrat Hashem, I'm hoping and praying, I'll end with this, that the sanity will prevail, which says if we continue like this, we're going to get nowhere fast. So Be'ezrat Hashem, the vast majority of Israelis are, I think, and I'll end with this, is to say, you always got people pushing to the extremes. What we need now, and the people in the extremes just want to keep the battle going. It's good for politics. It's good for them. We need that 70% majority to come together and say, you know what, let's find a way to make this move forward in a way which builds society and doesn't divide it. And that's going to be our big challenge. And I'm confident that despite the crisis, we will get there, Be'ezrat Hashem.
Thank you, Rabbi Peretz. It's already Friday where you are, so we'll let you go to bed and yashar koach.
Yeah, thank you.
Being in touch and
learning.
Thank you for this and for your insight and your words, and thank you very much.